this institution. And I've had the great pleasure of addressing you guys on a number of different topics over the years. We've covered a lot of contemporary topics, including beginning of life issues, infertility, end of life issues, organ transplantation, and the like. And Ritz Hashem, you'll get some of those also in other areas of your curriculum. But today's lecture actually is a little bit of a deviation from the norm. And I think, and I hope you will agree, this is an extremely important topic for discussion, one which is very relevant to us as Torah-observant Jews in the 21st century, a century where we have seen, in the last two centuries, we have seen extraordinary advances in the field of science and medicine that our predecessors could never have envisioned. And we thank, obviously, HaKadosh Baruch Hu for being the beneficiaries of this. And we are truly fortunate to have many different extraordinary advances and treatments that allow us to maintain our lives in ways which we never could before. And one of the areas that is often discussed by the thinking 21st century man in a field of science which has evolved is looking and learning. You're learning Makaros from the Gemara, learning Makaros from the Rishonim, which talk about science and medicine, all aspects of science and medicine. You guys haven't learned Hilchos Nida yet, have you?
Some have.
Some have, some haven't. Especially in the areas of Hilchos Nida, many other areas of Halacha, where you find, or many pages through Shas, you'll find discussions that relate to scientific issues, and you will often, A, struggle to understand exactly what Chazal were referring to, and B, in many cases, encounter passages which may seem to you, the 21st century mind, overtly contrary to the way we understand the science today in the 21st century. So the question is, how do we address these kinds of issues? What I'd like to do for you today, and here's our outline for our discussion today, first, I'd like to address this notion, this phrase, Nishtana HaTeva, and the limits of our presentation today. Secondly, which is the lion's share of our presentation today, I'd like to discuss with you the classic examples from the Gemara up to the Rishonim, early Achronim, that address this notion or highlight this notion, classic cases of highlighting the notion of Nishtana HaTeva. And finally, in conclusion, I'd like to discuss the major thematic approaches to passages in Chazal where the scientific understanding is not in consonance with modern scientific theory. So just a little help from you guys. How many people have an idea or what do they know about this phrase, Nishtana HaTeva? What does that mean to you, Nishtana HaTeva? Anybody have a guess what Nishtana HaTeva means? Or what does it mean to you? Yes?
Possible source of something in the Torah, say, by Kinim, that what the Torah dictates for what we see today by science and medicine are not necessarily the same.
So Nishtana HaTeva, good. Anyone else? Any other cases of Nishtana HaTeva that you guys are familiar with? Now you mentioned Kinim, which is obviously a classic one, which of course we'll discuss. Anyone else come across Nishtana HaTeva in any of their learning and any other topics or issues?
Hargasha.
I'm sorry?
Hargasha.
Hargasha, excellent. So in Nida, Hargasha, whether a woman senses the impending menstruation, Hargasha. So some say there's a Nishtana HaTeva there. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through the cases now that address the issue of Nishtana HaTeva. And I will tell you that the larger, broader issue of Nishtana HaTeva is sort of an undercurrent in many aspects of halacha. For example, in the psychology or psychological aspects, in women's issues, some say Nishtana HaTeva in terms of the understanding of women and the ability of women to serve in certain leadership roles in the community. Some say Nishtana HaTeva by Tav L'Meitav Tandu L'Meitav Armelo, whether a woman would prefer to stay unmarried or married. This is another aspect of Nishtana HaTeva, and there are many other arenas where you will find the expression Nishtana HaTeva. I'm not going to be addressing those issues. My discussion today is limited purely to the arena of science and medicine, in the areas where we find in Chazal, from the Gemara onwards, scientific discussions that are not in consonance with our scientific understanding today. So let us begin with a quote from one of the Chachmei Umos HaOlam, Galileo, who actually taught at the University of Padua, which we'll mention in another moment, one of our poskim, which we're going to mention today. also trained at the University of Padua. And the reason I bring this quote from Galileo is because it really relates to a key aspect of the whole discussions of the Ishtana Teva. And here you have this beautiful quote where he says, though scripture cannot err, its expounders and interpreters are liable to err in many ways, when they would base themselves always on the literal meaning of the words. Galileo could not believe that, quote, the same God who gave us our senses, our speech, our intellect, would have put aside the use of these to teach us instead such things as with their help we could find out for ourselves. In this way, Galileo reconciled the independence of the human mind with its loyalty to God and scripture, and he privately held this view despite public recantings for the rest of his life. Now, what Galileo points out, which also we are going to point out, is that the notion of Ishtana Teva is looking at a text and seeing a scientific theory in that text which seems not to be in consonance with the modern world. There is no discussion of Ishtana Teva with respect to the text of the Torah itself. So nobody at any stage of history has said that there is a pasuk in the Torah that is not in consonance with reality, and chas v'shalom rachmanu litzlan, that there's some aspect of the Torah which is, quote, not scientifically correct. Because the Torah itself can, by our own definition, by the fact that it's a Torah min ha-shamayim, can obviously not be incorrect. The only issue is, how does man interpret it? How has the interpretation evolved of different aspects of halacha throughout the centuries? So the text itself of the Torah is never a discussion about whether there's an issue of Ishtana Teva or not an issue of Ishtana Teva. But rather, it begins really from Shas onwards. And there you have, in the Torah Shebaal Peh, interpretations of halacha which require medical or scientific analyses, and in the course of those analyses, with the evolving scientific understanding, there was a realization that what was said in the Gemara or was said in Rishonim may not necessarily hold true at later periods in time. So here's a list of the sources that the chapters, so to speak, we'll be discussing today. The Kavra fish, Leidas Para, the birth of the Para, the extra lobe of the lung. And we'll go through these one by one. I encourage you guys to ask questions or to stop me for clarifications at any point in the course of our presentation. So the first mention of this notion of Nishtana Teva appears in the Gemara Moed Katan. And the Gemara Moed Katan says, Kivoshin shehu yochel lechol b'moed, kovshon. Certain brined fish, or fish that are treated in a certain way, that you are able to eat on the moed, on yontif, kovshon, you're allowed to perform that treatment process for the fish, the brining process of the fish, on chol moed, in order to facilitate your eating this fish on the moed itself. So Amar Rav, Amar Le Ada Tzayada, there was Ada who was a fisherman, said, Kavra Samuch L'Misrache Ma'ale. Kavra is a certain type of fish. Samuch L'Misrache, close to the time that it's spoiling or rotting, Ma'ale, that's the ideal or the best time to ingest this fish. So you shouldn't have this Kavra fish fresh, immediately when you catch it out of the waters. Rather, you should wait until it's just about to spoil, and you have the fish just about the time that it spoils, and that's the ideal form of the fish. So Tosos comments, Kavra somach l'misrche male, bizman hazeh tofsim sakana l'meichal somach l'sircha. In our days, and Tosos writing in the Middle Ages, this doesn't seem to be correct, because in fact, if you would eat a fish close to the stage of rotting, it might not only be more tasty, it might in fact be harmful to ingest such a fish. So Tosos here invokes one of the very earliest invocations of this phrase, b'shema nishtanu, maybe things have changed, nishtana teva, kimo should be refuos hashas, just like refuos hashas. Now what we will see here in the course of our presentation in the different chapters, and the reason I'm bringing these specific chapters for you is because these are the, quote, classic discussions of Nishtana Teva, and there's lots of cross-referencing of all these chapters between each other. So they're all referencing each other, so I think it's essential for you to understand every one of these chapters, every one of these issues, so when you're coming across the literature, you'll know exactly what the references are. And what did he write about before Sashas, which we'll talk about separately? She'enem tovos bizman hazeh, that they're not helpful or beneficial today. Okay, that was chapter one, the first case where it was invoked, an acknowledgement, a realization that a factual information based on observation in the Gemara had possibly changed in the course of time. And here's another classic example. And this is Leidas Parah, the birthing of cows. And here, this comes from the Gemara in Bechoros. And the Mishnah in Bechoros says, Halokeach behema min ha'oved kachavi. You are purchasing a behema from a goy. And the shiloh there is, that behema, the bechor of a behema, has to go to the kohen. But when you purchase a behema from an akum, you don't know if that behema gave birth prior to your purchase. So how are you going to know with certainty that if this animal subsequently gives birth to another bechor, or another a fetus, a child, if that child is considered a bechor, that child's not considered a bechor. So it goes through the different animals and how you're going to determine. So it says, any day in bichrim lo bichrim, you don't know if it already had a bechor or not. Rabbi Shmuel Omer, Eiz bashna so vade lekohen, mikan beilach safek, Rachel bashna tzayim, vade lekohen, etc. Para vichamor, a cow and a donkey, benos sholosh, if you're purchasing this animal, when it's just beginning its third year of life, vadai lekohen, if it has subsequent progeny, that progeny definitely goes to the kohen. Why? And mikan beilach safek. But if you purchase a 4 or 5 year old behema, then if it gives birth to another animal, you don't know if that animal is a bechor or not. So Tosos writes here in Bechoros, par v'chamor benos sholosh vadai lekohen. So after a possible interpretation or analysis, he adopts the following interpretation: Shma Nina, Toch Shtaim Lo Yiloda Klal. So it must be, Tosos claims, and this is the pretty much accepted interpretation, although there are some variants, that the nature of the cow is that for the first 2 years of the cow's life, cow does not give birth at all. So when you're purchasing an animal which is now beginning its third year of life, there is no havamina that it was bichra before, that it gave birth to a bichor before, because the observation of nature, or the veterinary observation is, or the veterinary fact, that this cow could not have given birth before because a cow does not give birth until the third year of life. And this was the fact based upon which the Tosfos is interpreting the Mishnah in Bechoros. So in Avodah Zarah, commenting on this sugya, Toso says, Parah v'chamor bas sholosh shonim vadai lekohen. Perish, dekodim sholosh vadai lo yilada, that before 3 years definitely would not have given birth. V'yesh li t'moa. We have a question on this fact. The hamase b'chol yom, the parah bat shtei noshim yoledes. So now we have our observation flies in the face of this statement of the Gemara. If the Gemara says that in fact a para doesn't give birth for the first 2 years, we see every day, if you go to the farms, you will see cows that are giving birth to baby calves when they're chronologically less than 2 years old. So what does Tosos say? Tosos invokes this famous phrase, Yesh lomar devadai ato nishtana ha'es. Now clearly things have changed. Mikimo shehaya b'doros harishonim. So the nature has changed from the times of the Rishonim. Now, the subcontext here, and I'll just deviate for a moment, it's very complex issues, and there's many, many layers of interpretation of Nishtana Teva. So the simple meaning of Nishtana Teva means that genuinely, had you had a cow from the times of the Gemara, that cow would not have given birth for the first 2 years, but now a cow in the Middle Ages is physiologically able to give birth less than 2 years. That's the classic conventional interpretation of Nishtana Teva. Now, there's a subtext of interpretation of Nishtana Teva, which will also come out in some of the chapters we're discussing, which means that maybe our observation of nature has changed, but the nature itself hasn't changed, which might mean that this same cow maybe was able to give birth in less than 2 years at the times of the Gemara, but they didn't have the observation of the studies to determine whether, in fact, cows are giving birth less than 2 years or not. And you'll see in the other chapters this idea will become more clear. But what is invoked here is this notion again that a statement in the Gemara is no longer applicable because the facts on the ground today run counter to that observation. Yes.
Suggesting that sometime, like in the previous Tosfos, when we cut down, we said Shema Nishtana Teva here, Tosfos is saying Vadai.
Ah, excellent. All right. So, you know, maybe Tosfos there was a little more hesitant to invoke it, but here, so that in that case. Right. So the reason why it's easier to say Vadai here is because it's very obvious to observe, and there's simply no way to interpret otherwise. So with respect to eating a fish, you know, it's debatable whether you're going to get sick or you're not going to get sick. So they didn't have scientific studies to prove it one way or another. But here, everybody is seeing these cows that are less than 3 years old giving birth. So clearly, Vadai Nishtana Ateva. The question is, how do you interpret that? But there's no question that the facts are very clearly interpretable in only one way, that this cow has is now able to give. So your Ha'ara is a good Ha'ara. Yes?
Another reasonable answer is the Tosfos, and Mori Kata gives several answers. So
okay, good, good. Excellent. Also another possibility. So what does Tosfos here say? It says, Yishlomer devade ata nishtana teva nishtana ha'es mi kimo shahayu v'dos v'shonim kimo Inunisa Devarda. Just like Inunisa Devarda. Now, what is Inunisa Devarda? Glad you asked that question, because that's what we're going to talk about next. So these are cross-references again. All these Tosafim are cross-referencing each other, so you'll know all these cases, so you know all the cross-references, you'll know the parallel sugyas that are all cited by different Rishonim. So here we have a Gemara and Chulin. Gemara and Chulin, you guys learn Chulin yet? You learn Chulin later, right? So here you have the Gemara in Chulin, which says, Amar Rava, this, by the way, is the lungs of a cow. But Amar Rava, Hey Oni Is Leila Rea. There are five lobes, anatomical lobes, to the lung. Apo Klape Gavra, if the face of the animal is facing the individual, Tlasim Yamin Taitan Ismola, three on the right and two on the left. So it's interesting that the Gemara does this, because we do this in anatomy also. In anatomy class, you have to establish your field of vision in order to be able to determine the anatomy. So we have a lot of medical terms: ventral, dorsal, caudal, cephalad, caudad. So basically, you have to know, you know, if you're facing the body from the front, if you're facing the body from the back, how are you going to understand the anatomy? So the Gemara very astutely says, you're facing the animal, so there's three lobes on the right and two on the left. Chosir, o yosir, o cholif trefa. If you have one less than these lobes, one extra than these lobes, or one of the lobes is anatomically malpositioned, this animal is considered a trefa. So I'm just going to skip ahead a little bit in the Gemara. And the Gemara says that the lobes have to be aligned in a certain way. It says, aval, baini, baini, trefa. It talks about an extra lobe. If there's an extra lobe in the middle of the section of lobes, so if you have, you know, three on the right and two on the left, or if there's one sitting in the middle, that would constitute a trefa and confer the status of trefa on the animal. So then Gemara says, "Ahu beini beini, de'asulakamei de Ravashi." There was an animal that they brought the lungs to Ravashi, and it had a lobe of the lung which was in the center, which technically should render it a trefa. So Ravashi lemitrefe. Ravashi says it should be trefa. Amar Rav Huna Mar Bar Avya. There's a whole category of beasts, of wild animals, that have this exact anatomical lobe in the middle between the right lobes and the left lobes. So how could you say this is trefa? The Karole Tabcha, and the butchers call this unique lobe that's in the middle of between the right lobes and the left lobes, Inunisa Devarda. Devarda, Varda means rose. Even the Hebrew name Varda is rose, like Shoshana. So they call it the lobe of the rose-shaped lobe, because that's what it looks like. It's a relatively small lobe. So then he answers the Hanimili, Begavoy, Abalagaba, Filu Kitar Fadasa Trefa. So he answers a certain anatomical way, that one way would be trefa, one way wouldn't be trefa. But here again you have, in the Tosis and Fulham, Venira de Ain Ryan Behemoth Shalon. So you can't use our behemoths now in the Middle Ages if you're looking at the anatomy of the animals in the Middle Ages. You can't bring a raya to this Gemara's discussion. De Shema Chalukos Mishelahen. Because maybe our behemoths are different than the behemoths of the times of the Gemara. Kid Ashkechon Perkalokeh Behemoth, as we find in Bechoros, De Pora Bas Shlosha Shiyolda Vadei LeKohen. So here again, the cross-referencing, because there are other examples, and here they bring an example from the animal world, which is clearly relevant here, because the animals have changed. So don't try and bring the Araya from the animals of the Gemara to the animals of today, to the animals of the Gemara, because this Aninusa, Inunisa Devarda, this special unique lobe of the lung, is no longer present in our behemoths, because in essence, Nishtana HaTeva. And here's another classic case from the Gemara about of Nishtana Teva. And here it's Yoledes Limikutoin. Limikutoin means, you know, partial or not complete. So here the Gemara, the context of the Gemara, just to place the Gemara in context, the Gemara is talking about the birth of Yitzchak, Sarah's pregnancy with Yitzchak, trying to find out exactly the gestational time that Yitzchak stayed within the womb of Sarah. And it says, I forget the exact pasuk, maybe one of you guys can remind me, it says something about Moed, Kayes Chayel, the Sarah Bain, but before the Moed, I just can't remember the pasuk before the Moed, but it says that so the Gemara says that not only was Yitzchak conceived on a moed, he was actually born on a moed. So it's a limud from that pasuk that he was born on a moed. So the Gemara tries to figure out all the different variations and permutations about using all the different regalim to try and figure out exactly how long Yitzchak stayed in utero for Sarah. So the Gemara says if it's Pesach to Sukkos, I mean Pesach to Shavuos rather, you know, how many days are there between Pesach and Shavuos? 50 days, right? So Gemara says, well, I mean, where do you find a gestation of anybody that's only 50 days long? So then it uses all the other variations and permutations to try and figure out exactly how long Yitzchak was in utero to Sarah. So in that context, you have this Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, which says, Amar Mar Zutra, Afilu Lamanda Amar Yoledes Letisha Eina Yoledes Limakutain, Yoledes Leshiva Yoledes Limakutain. So this reveals to us a notion which is perpetuated in the Gemara, and we'll see in a moment has potential halachic ramifications, that the belief was that if a woman enters the ninth month of pregnancy, that once you're in the ninth month, you will not give birth until you have completed 9 months of gestation. So you let this letisha, once you're conceiving, you're already gestating into the ninth month, you cannot give birth prior to the completion of the ninth month. So Yoledes Letisha, Eina Yoledes Limikutain. You don't give birth in partial 9 months, you only give birth in complete 9 months. However, Yoledes Leshiva, when you're pregnant into the seventh month of gestation, you don't need to complete the seventh month, the whole 7 months of gestation, you only need to complete partial seven month gestation. And we will see in a moment extensive discussions in the about the treatment of the 8 month baby. How many people here are familiar with the Ben Ches, 8 month baby? But the 8 month baby is treated differently in halachic literature than a 7 month gestation baby versus a 9 month gestation baby. Fascinating sugya. So here you have a tshuva of the Rashbash addressing this issue. Rashbash writing in the 15th century says, "Zechol kayotzu miklal shmona chadashim v'nichnas lachodesh atshi, afil yom echad chutz miyom shnizabra, af api shlo gomru simona v'lo shoha shloshim yom, vlad gomruhu." And he adds, "Kfar tamu al ze rabim," and he underlined in line 3, "Kfar tamu al ze rabim shari achush machziv ze, v'anisoyon emes hafcho shari harbi nashim kelen shnichnasos yom echad miyom achodesh atshi, Yoldos Vlad Shel Kayama." So he actually is challenging this notion, which is a notion perpetuated in the Gemara, that we see, also just like the case where they observed that cows would give birth when they were less than 2 years of age, they say we see every day that women who are entering their ninth month of pregnancy, they don't wait till they're completing their ninth month of pregnancy in order to give birth. They're giving birth in day 2 of the ninth month, day 10, day 15, and also all cases which seem to negate this notion. And he actually, the Rashbash actually accepts the possibility that Nishtana HaTeva, and he writes, even though he entertains this, at the end he actually paskins. Here he writes, "Af pi shebizmanam haya al inyan echad, imnim tza'ata al inyan acher lo mipnei kach Nishtana hadin." So this is a key thing which he discusses. Just because the reality has changed doesn't mean that the halacha has necessarily changed. But he himself actually, and we'll see where that's relevant in many other chapters, which we'll see presently, but here he writes, he does entertain that in this particular case, he would accept the possibility that Nishtana Teva, and it would impact on Halacha. Now, what is the case where it becomes relevant? We'll see actually in a moment. But actually, I'll share with you in a few moments. So Shulchan Aruch also paskins this, in Haggah, Shulchan Aruch in the Hilchos Yibum. V'yesh omrim de bizman hazeh, this is the Ramah, afilu lo nichnasa b'chodesh hatshi rak yom echad milvad, Levad Yom Shni Sabrebo, Havi Vlad Kayama. Now let me explain, and I have to explain a little bit here before we get to the full discussion of the 8-month case. Since, so what if the baby's not born in full 9 months? What is the potential halachic relevance and halachic application? So halachic relevance is the following case. If the child is not considered a Vlad Shel Kayama, not considered a full-fledged Vlad, then it has the status of a Nafel, then it wouldn't be pater someone from Yibum or Chalitza. So if you have a woman who gives birth to such a child, and then that child dies, and she didn't have any other children, and her husband dies, does the brother then have to do Yibum or Chalitza with that woman or not? So this is also predicated on the fact that if the child is not a full 9-month child, then the child is born in the 8th month. And here let me just share with you a preface to the 8-month discussion. And we'll discuss it more extensively in a minute. Just see if it's our very next, it's not. But you know what, I'll go to that discussion now and then we'll come back. So the, okay, here we go. So the Gemara says in a number of places, here we start with the Yerushalmi, the discussion of the 8-month baby. Minayin shtei yitziros. It says, by yitzer es ha'adam. Minayin shtei yitziros. How do we know there are two yitziros, two types of creations? So Rabbi Zeira b'shem Rabbi Huna, b'yitzer yitzira l'shiva, yitzira l'tisha. There is a creation of a 7th month baby, and there's a creation of a 9-month baby. B'yitzira l'tisha notzer l'shiva v'nolad l'shmona chai. Kol shekein l'tisha notzer l'tisha v'nolad l'shmona yachai. So let me explain this, and please, if I'm not explaining it sufficiently, don't hesitate to ask me to help clarify. This is a very interesting sugya. The notion was that a baby born in 7 months gestation would be a viable fetus and would survive and be healthy. A baby born in the 9th month, and according to this additional aspect of the Gemara, after completion of 9 months, because Yoledes Letisha, Yoledes Enon, Yoledes Mikatonin, would be a viable, healthy baby. But a baby born in the 8th month of gestation would not be a viable baby, would in essence be a Nafel, and would not survive. So the question you will ask me, which is a question the Gemara struggles with, how on earth do you know if it's an 8th month baby, a 7th month baby, or a 9-month baby? I mean, who's doing the calculations exactly? Nobody takes calculations when Bia occurred, and if multiple Bias occurred, you're not going to know which Bia created the child to know exactly if this child is a 7th month baby, 8th month baby, 9th month baby. So they struggled with this in practical application. So if they had a baby in front of them, and Lamaisa, they didn't know if it was a survivable baby or not, because the halacha was, as we'll see, and let's just finish up what the halachic discussions are about this 8-month baby. So here you have the Gemara in Shabbos, which says, Amar Mar, below Suffolk Doches HaShabbos LaSuye Mai. What is the case of, that a Suffolk isn't Doches Shabbos? LaSuye Ha Detan Rabbanon, Ben Shiva Mechalin Alaves HaShabbos, Ben Shmone Ein Mechalin Alaves HaShabbos. So here's a very concrete halachic application of this understanding. If you are a physician in the Middle Ages and you have a baby that you think is a 7th month gestation baby, and that baby's life is at risk, you can be Mechal Shabbos for that baby. If you are certain that this baby is an 8-month gestation baby, and it's Shabbos and this baby's having respiratory distress, you cannot be Mechal Shabbos to save this baby, because this baby doesn't have a Cheskes Chaim because it was born in the 8th month. And that's a huge halachic relevance. So you have to know, and there's extensive discussions, how do you know if this baby's 7th month, 8th month, and using sort of a scientific perspective, they would say, well, the 7th month baby is a viable fetus. Maybe this child was really the Yetzira, which was prospectively supposed to be a 7th month baby, but it stayed in the womb a little longer into the 8th month, and it's really a viable child. Or maybe it's really an 8th month baby. How do we exactly know? So here we have the Tosis and Shabbos already asks a question on this notion of Ben Shmona. Does Ben Shmona harehu ke'eben v'osur l'taltalo? Ben Shmona is considered like an Eben with respect to Shabbos. You're not allowed to be metaltal the baby, you can't touch the baby, you can't carry the baby, and you can't even be Mechal Shabbos to save the life of the baby. Nira l'ri de'achshav mutur l'taltal kol tinokos. Today, in the Middle Ages, it's mutur to carry all babies. She'ein anu b'kin v'kulam kamos safik ben ches, safik ben tes. Because we don't know exactly who's an 8-month baby, who's not an 8-month baby. and it's suffik, either suffik ben zayin ben ches or ben ches ben tes, and there's halachic nuances between those two, which we're not going to get into today. But this is even paskin lahalacha. Shulchan Aruch or Chaim in Shin Lamed Havlad Shinolad Osin L'Kol Tzracha V'Marchitzin Yoso U'Molchin Yoso V'Tomnin Ashilya. Tomnin is to bury the placenta. Kadei Shiachem Havlad V'Choskin is a Tabur. Tabur is the umbilical cord. You can cut the umbilical cord in the course of birth. V'Hani Mili V'Nolad L'Tetzel L'Zayin. So all these things you're allowed to do on Shabbos is only when a baby's born in from the seventh month, a seventh month baby or a 9 month baby. Aval nolad l'ches, but if it was born as an 8 month baby, osufik ben zayin o ben ches, ein mechalin alav el in gomer sarav tzikarno. Again, there's lengthy discussions here, but you cannot be mechal Shabbos for that baby unless the baby is, and this expression you'll find very frequently in these issues, gomer sarav tzikarno, meaning it had hair and fingernails, meaning anatomical evidence that this baby had complete gestation. So it's more developed. So if you have a real premature infant that looks very premature, and you have a suffix that's an 8 month baby, you're not allowed to be mechal Shabbos for that. Only a baby that has anatomical evidence that it has actually progressed to more development are you allowed to be mechal Shabbos. Again, a massive halachic ramifications, practical halachic ramifications for neonatal treatment. Yes.
So is an 8 month baby less developed than a 7 month baby?
Ah, so that is precisely the question: is this factually true? Or is this not factually true? So let's continue, and we'll answer that question. First of all, and this is an aspect which I'll say briefly, but please remember this because this is an important nugget. Many of these issues that you find in the Gemara, people erroneously believe are a product entirely of Chazal. They view Chazal in a vacuum. So in some cases that is appropriate. But in matters of science and medicine, it's not always appropriate. And this is one of those areas, and there are many, many others, that this notion of the viability of the 8 month baby not surviving was a classic notion from the times of antiquity, from the times of Hippocrates, that it was this belief that the 8 month baby would not survive, that the 7 month would survive, and the 9 month would survive, but the 8 month would not survive. And there are three basic reasons for this. And one of the reasons was an anatomical reason. One of the reasons was a mathematical reason, based on the number of days of pregnancy and their notions of the likelihood of survival based on purely mathematics. And the third was an astrological reason. And the astrological reason was that each month is associated with a planet. The 8 month was associated with Saturn. Saturn, according to that the astrological tradition, was the planet of death. So there's no way that a child born in the 8th month under the planet of Saturn would be able to survive. Now the question you ask me is that medical reality today? Do we understand that to be medical reality today? So the answer to that is no, we do not. We do not. And I'll explain it and you'll see it for a moment when they began to realize this. Just parenthetically, this is from the Rashba, of Shum ben Semach Duran. It's another thread here with the 8 month baby. That actually quotes from the Gracious Rabbi, the fascinating Gracious Rabbi. I had to ask my father-in-law the interpretation of this. My father-in-law is Professor Feldman, professor of classics, Greek and Latin. How many people here have the courage to take Dr. Feldman? Okay, we got two people. That's pretty impressive. It's more than me, by the way. I didn't take him when I was in college. Here you have from the Gracious Rabbi, they're talking about the Shnei Yetziros. Minayin shehanotzo l'shiva chai. How do you know that the seven survives? So Amar Lahun, they said to him, Miditchun ana mimati lahun. From your own language, meaning to the secular world, from the secular world we will infer this, and it's a play on words from the Greek letters. It's zeta apta, eta acto. Now zeta is like Zion, the seventh letter, and eta acto is the eighth letter. But the play on words is eta, instead of meaning eight, means rather than. So Zeta Apta, the seventh one, survives Eta rather than Akto, the eighth one. So the seventh month child will survive, very clever play on words, but the eighth month child will not survive. Here you have a fascinating statement from the Rashbits, that the Goyim say the following, the Heim Omri, Himasha Anolad Leches Chadoshim Eno Vlad Shel Kayama, Umipnei Sheyeshu Hanotzri Nolad Leches Chadoshim. there's a notion that that Yeshu was born as an 8-month baby. The gazar al kol hanoladim v'ches chadashim shelo yiskaimu. That subsequent to Yeshu's birth, nobody would survive the eighth month. So here you have this case opposed, which we mentioned before, and this case is opposed to the Rivash, and this was a case, a real halachic shaila, of a woman who had bia with her husband, and he died within a few days later, and the child was born in the 8th month. And then the child died at 29 days, before 30 days, before being removed from the status of Nathal. So the question was, this woman had no other children, and as it turns out, her husband's brother was not even available to do the chalitza, so she was basically condemned to a life of solitude. Is he going to be matir her, you know, or is he not going to be matir potentially with chalitza or not? Does she need yibum chalitza, or does she not need any yibum chalitza because she gave birth to a child from her husband? So he actually paskins. He said, "Mizbar be'edim shem yom misa sabal ad yom leida sabas yesh shmona chadashim." So she was clearly within the 8th month. And he paskins the following: he says, "She'ein lanu ladun b'dinei toraseinu mitzoseha al pichach mehatevera v'harfua." He says, "I don't care what the scientists of today tell you about this 8-month baby. She'im nanuli divrayim ein torah min hashamayim chalila." Because we have nothing but the Torah Hakdosha to guide us. Torah HaKadosha says an 8-month baby doesn't survive. This was an 8-month baby. This baby didn't survive. And so therefore this woman has to perform chalitza, and she's therefore condemned to a life of solitude based on Epsilon. Now where this became more interesting is in the late 19th, early 20th century, they developed the incubator to treat children who were born prematurely. They put them in an incubator, and in this incubator, they'd survive to much greater longevity than they would survive without the incubator. So you take premature infants that were born very early gestational ages that before that time would have all died. They put them in this incubator, which is basically just a warming box. And that warming box, maintaining that higher temperature, facilitated the health of these children. And this is what the incubator looked like in 1898. And what you have here is, to my knowledge, I think, the very first halachic discussion addressing the issue of the 8-month baby and the problem that it presents for the 8-month baby sugya with the development of this brand new technology, with the development of the incubator. Because you had babies which were 100% 8-month babies by the calendar, but if you put them in the incubator, they would clearly survive and live and thrive. So how do they address this kind of issue? So this is in a journal called Hapeles, and here they write, "Hadasha nichuda tzamcha b'sadeh chachmas arfuni b'meyo ele." There's a new development in medicine. "V'hi lechazeik l'havri yiladim shelo shilmu yimei hiryonam v'noldu kol kodmuzmanam." It's to treat premature infants. "Ayidei tanur muchni," it's a mechanical oven, really. It's in essence what it was. It was a heating box, a heating drawer. "V'hu tevas zechuki sasher mayim rotchi mechamim osachom tmidi of 32 degrees." So there was a mechanism whereby water would circulate and the temperature would be a consistent 32 degrees. So what he said, I'll summarize here. So what he writes is that the chief rabbi of Basel heard about this new technology and he wanted to get as much information as possible to try and paskin to see what the halachic issues would be relating to this and how it relates to the sugya of the 8-month baby, which you were not allowed to be mechal Shabbos for a baby who's 8 months gestation. So what's interesting is that this is 1901 where this is written. What do they do? And this is the methodology which we employ to this very day. They turned to the physicians of the time. And they went to the physicians, and they told the physicians, or they asked the physicians, what is the story with the 8-month baby? Is it in fact true that 8-month babies survive? And what's the story with this incubator? Does incubator now change the medical reality? These babies that didn't survive before, do they survive now? So they asked a number of physicians, and this is a letter from one of those physicians. Michtav Mehadok, Michtav Beis, the second letter. Mehadok Dr. Vav, I don't know who it is. Laharav mi Basel, to the rabbi in Basel at that time. Tofresh Samech Aleph, Rav Mod Nechbad, etc., etc. So here he's writing, and this is a fascinating lesson on the evolution of scientific knowledge. Says Mekom Hadover Shikarosi, who has sefer al hamachalos shel hamuubaros, lamayaled hanoda letehila Maritza. Shechai b'mei Ludwig ha-14th, ve'elu dvarav. So who is he quoting? He's living in the 20th century, literally the cusp of the 20th century. Who's he quoting for his scientific knowledge? Morisseau. Who is Morisseau? Morisseau was a physician from the 1600s. And what is Morisseau writing? What is the first line of Morisseau's comment? L'das Hippocrate. Who's Hippocrate? So he, in the 1600s, is quoting Hippocrates. And this person in the 20th century is quoting a 17th century source, who's in turn quoting a source from antiquity, Hippocrates. What did Hippocrates write? Yelet shenola b'chodesh hashmini l'irayon. You know what? Let's go to the original source. This is the book from 16. This is obviously a later English translation. It's written in French. This is a later edition. The diseases of women with child and in childbed. And this is what Francis Morisseau wrote in 1675. It says, I do boldly affirm, and it is also very true, that the ordinary term of going with child is 9 whole months. But I cannot consent that children born in the 7th month do oftener live than those in the 8th month. But much to the contrary. I believe that the nearer they approach to the natural term of 9 months, the stronger they are. And therefore, that children born in the 8th month rather live than those of the 7th month. So he's writing already in the 1600s with this realization that the 8th month is not a unique month, and quite the contrary. And we obviously believe this to be the truth today also. The longer the gestation, the more survivable the child is. So it's not only is an 8-month baby not worse off than a 7-month baby, an 8-month baby is better off than a 7-month baby because it's been in the mother's womb for a longer period of gestation. But he concludes, and this Yaakov Vilyanevsky is the author who collected all the data from the physicians and the halachic sources, and he concludes, V'hachi kaimel ha-halacha, apilu im yochichu harofim b'hafachos beruros, shelevadai ben ches gamke mo'il ha-tachulos tanur ha-muchni la-asoso bar kayama. Even if physicians will testify that 100%, they can take an 8-month baby and make that baby survive. Kedivrei Dr. Shapiro, Ladas, Kol Harofim, Shagam Biladei, Ezra, Satanur, Shkiche, Bnei Chestifai. I mean, even without the incubator, it was already known at this period of time that 8-month children could survive. Becholzos, Ein Stira Chalila Ladas Chazal. There is not a contradiction to the words of Chazal. Shemi Pihem Anu Chaim, from their mouths we live. Balacha ulamaisa, shekol divreim hurak al pisod Hashem lireiv, shirak hanotzu mitchilas b'riyaso l'tes, hu she'en ochai, im nolad kodem zmano b'ches, umachshiv l'zayin. Aval notzu mitchila l'zayin, yochol l'hashos b'mei ha'imo v'tseisa b'ches, k'mo shekosav shi'yichya, kol shken shi'yichya. So basically what he's saying is that, and what makes this such a fascinating sugya, is that, you know, it's interpretable even through the eyes of Chazal. Because a baby that you're looking at, this baby that's now born in eight months and 6 days, you know, Chazal said, even at that time already, that maybe this was a 7th month Yetzira, which was a viable child, but Ishtehe, it remained in utero up to the middle of the 8th month. So it's not an absolute clear contradiction to the words of Chazal. Even today, you can interpret the viability of these children within the words of Chazal. But obviously, that's it's a stretched interpretation and a complicated interpretation. But we see Bizman Hazeh, both the Chazon Ish and the Shlomo Zalman Orbach, do invoke this notion of Nishtana Teva with respect to the 8th month baby. So you're going to ask me, you know, in the hospital, if you have a woman who you know for sure has an 8-month baby, are you allowed to be Mechal Shabbos to save that 8-month baby, or are you not allowed to be Mechal Shabbos? Do we pass in like the Mechaber, or do we say Bizman Hazeh, you're allowed to be Mechal? So this is a classic case where the Achronim invoke Nishtana HaTeva. And here we write, and this is from the Chazon Ish, Mechalin Olav Es HaShabbos L'Refuoso V'chein Me'idim Achshav Uvdos Rabos D'Bnei Ches Chaim Miskaimim. And today we see that many 8-month babies survive. Bayomim Harishonim Hayomiyu Tamotzu Yishinigmeru L'Zayin Ruben L'Tisha Avalo Hayonigmerin L'Shmono Fikach Amru Hay Ben Shiva Hu V'Ishdeh. So in essence, and there's interpretation over here, but suffice it to say that here there is an invocation, really, of the classic Nishtana HaTeva, at least by the Chazon Ish, that indeed, that had you lived at the times of the Gemara, the Chazon Ish is saying, It would have been otherwise. The eighth-month baby would not have survived, at least so frequently. But today, Bizman Hazeh, the eight-month baby does survive. So nature really has changed. The physiology has changed, according to the Chazon Ish. And based on that notion that the physiology has changed, therefore, the halacha has changed. The halacha is now, you are allowed to move Chal Shabbos, because now the eighth-month baby does survive. Which, by the way, is different than saying, and this is a subtle or not-so-subtle point, it's different than saying that the medical information in the times of the Gemara is not correct medical information, and that even in the times of the Gemara, that information was incorrect. It's not the same thing. Here you're saying that the times of the Gemara, it was correct in the times of the Gemara, and it's correct today. The halacha will change because the factual information has changed. Factually, the eight-month baby didn't survive then. That's what the halacha was, the way the halacha was then. Factually, the eight-month baby survives today. So the eight-month baby, you're allowed to be Chal Shabbos today. Now, there are those that argue against that, and the Minchas Yitzchak is one of them, and he maintains that, in fact, the eight-month baby, even Bizman Hazeh, you may not be necessarily able to be Mechal Shabbos for. I'm just going to scoot back to some of these other classic sugyas. Now, another classic sugya which is invoked, the whole issue of Nishtana Teva is invoked, where clearly today there is a realization that the reality has changed. That's in the area of trefos. Now the Gemara talks about Yud Ches trefos. There are 18 trefos, and those trefos are halacha l'moshe misina. Exactly what those trefos are. There's a list of those trefos. They're all halacha l'moshe misina. Now the Gemara there's a machlokas whether a trefa by definition is an animal that will not survive for more than 12 months. Now there's machlokas whether it's 100% that they will not survive for 12 months or strong likelihood that they will not survive for 12 months. But let's rest on the assumption that the halacha is that the trefo will definitely not survive 12 months. Yes?
Is that a Gemara somewhere?
You know, I don't know offhand, but the Gemara in Chulin talks about the Yud Ches trefos. Whether
12 months.
The Yud Beis Chodesh is mentioned in the Gemara.
Or a trefo by an animal, or
a trefo by human? So it's definitely by trefo an animal, and that's an absolute by trefo for an animal. With respect to trefos adam, it's a different sugya. And the Rambam famously is mechalik between trefos adam and trefos behemoth. The Rambam relies on the Gemara's Yud Ches trefos as definitive trefos for behemoth. But with respect to man, the Rambam says explicitly that it's defined by the medical understanding of the time as to which human being would be considered a trefo. And the halachic ramifications for a human trefo are different. So for example, you chayiv ritzicha, if you kill a trefo, in end-of-life issues, you know, is even shadows whether you can harvest an organ from a trefa to transplant to a non-trefa. There are potential loch ramifications, even Bizman Hazeh, for a human trefa. But the 12-month period is absolute for the animal trefa and is tethered specifically to the Yud Ches trefos mentioned in the Gemara. The 12-month period is also by Adam, but which diseases fall into that category of trefa will vary from generation to generation, and pretty much everyone passes like that with the Rambam. Just by the way, a halachic ramification of the trefa with respect to contemporary medicine. So if Moshe Feinstein Zatzal, you know, invokes trefa with respect to medical decision making for someone who has a poor prognosis. So let's say someone has a very serious medical condition and they're offered to undergo a surgical procedure. You know, there's a 50% chance, and their prognosis is 6 months with no treatment. With surgical intervention, they could have a longevity of 3 years, but conversely, they could die on the table. So that's scenario A. Scenario B is, without intervention, they have a prognosis of 3 months. With intervention, they have a prognosis of 11 months. So Moshe says, he uses trefa in that equation. So if a person can undergo a treatment which will remove him from the status of trefa, so his longevity will be more than that 12-month longevity, then at least he has the option, may not have the chiyuv, it depends on the scenario, to undergo that treatment and to take that risk of dying on the table for the possibility of a greater longevity. But if it's only chai shah, which is used in the trefon chai shah for him are synonymous, if it's only chai shah, he only has within 12 months with the intervention A and still within 12 months with the intervention B, then it's usher for him to undergo that procedure. So the Rashba is faced with the following question. The Rashba is in the 1200s. And the Rashba is writing, and he says, She'elas behema shenimseis yoseres eiver ve'osan eivarim shehid nitrefes behen ve'makom shenitrefes bo. So there was an animal that had one of the classic yud chesrefes. He doesn't enumerate which one it is. And he's barer she'avro le'ashnemas or chodesh. And lo and behold, this animal was followed chronologically, and in 12 months and one day, it was still alive. And the Gemara says that these yud chesrefes, they're not going to survive more than 12 months. So Shaila was mi neima kevin she'avro le'yud beis chodesh be'bada einu nitrefes. Maybe, even though it's one of the classic yud chesrefes in the Gemara, if it survived more than 12 months, it's a proof that it's not a trefa. And maybe you can eat it. M'shechta, you can eat it. Or not. So the Rashba answers in a very strong fashion, very, very definitive fashion. Tshuva. Imra isu v'shamat, this is the second paragraph. Imra isu v'shamat, misha mekil mafshir v'yoseres, v'chol ma shemonu chachamim mikala trefus, al tishmalo. If you ever in your life hear someone being mekil about hilchos trefus, this yudchos trefus that Chazal enumerated, you're not allowed to listen to him. V'lo sove'olav, v'lo siya kazos b'yisrael. There should never be people like this propounding such ludicrous notions. Someone who would matter such a thing is considered like motzi laz on Chazal. And I am going to write you a lengthy tshuva. I'm not going to concise this. So this is not, he's making it very clear, this is a landmark tshuva that I am writing for everybody to know and to draw the lines in the sand to make it very clear what my position is. It says, V'lo ya'asu divrei chachmei Yisrael ha'mekudashim kegedra adechuya v'ola shu'ol ha'paratz. The kevin shekein, and therefore, afilu yatsu kama v'yomru kachro inu anu machinu shu'osa. Even if people stand up in a public square and say, we have seen all these animals that are listed as Yidchas Trefus and are all living more than 12 months, said we have to deny their words, Kedesh Yadibri Chachamim Kayamim, etc. V'yivatel, this is a classic phrase, V'yivatel Hamei Be'elef Kayotzebo. V'yivatel, one person who testifies and 1,000 like him, V'al Tevatel Nekudo Achas Mimash Shehiskimu Kol Chachmei Yisrael HaKadoshim. And not one iota of what Chazal said should be cast aside. Dvarim shenamru l'moshe misina. Kama tzrichim balei nefesh ve'achel asher noga alekim b'livam li'shomer li'srachek mina makilim. So stay far away from makilim. I think you get the point. Okay, and these are just small excerpts of a very repetitive tshuva, which makes it very clear. Now the kasha is this interpretation of the Rashba said that whatever you do to Chatrefus, you cannot ever deviate from that. You cannot, you know, is this a generalizable tshuva or a localized tshuva? So is this tshuva meant exclusively to only Hilchos Trefus? And anyone who ever is Malshin Trefus, and I'll get to your question in a second, because this Trefus happens to be Halacha L'moshe Mi-Sinai, or is it generalizable to all aspects of Nishtan HaTeva, and don't you ever tell me that anything written in the entire Shas is not in consonance with the medical reality? And if you come and testify that kinim, we'll talk about second, spontaneously generate, or don't spontaneously generate, then you know, yivatel echad elach kamo. So that's a shal. Yes, you had a question.
What about the Dvarim Sachem when they admit they were wrong? They were completely...
Ah, excellent. Okay, I think that's our next sugya. So let's finish off this trefus, and then we will get to that astronomical debate in just a moment. So here, the Chazon Ish, and I'll just synopsize it for you. The Chazon Ish has a classic interpretation of this Hilchos Trefus. Because the Chazon Ish, the Rashba is living in the Middle Ages, but the Chazon Ish is living in the modern world. And it's very clear in the modern world, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that many of the conditions that are listed in the Hilchos Trefus are living longer than 12 months. So it's going to be much more difficult for the Chazon Ish to defend that position. So the Chazon Ish has a wholly unique interpretation. And again, the question is if this position is generalizable or not generalizable. But here's the Chazon Ish's position in a nutshell. He says it is in fact true that things have evolved and that animals which didn't live 12 months back in the Middle Ages or back in the times of Mar are now able to live longer periods of time. So you might say, the nature has changed, so therefore I'll change the halacha. So Chazanish says no. Because the halacha was nikba based on whatever was the contemporary science of Chazal when they were koveya the halacha. So if at the time of Chazal, again, implicit in this, or not so implicit, is that according to Chazanish, there clearly was a hishtanut hatvaim. So this same animal, if it would have had this trait from back in the Middle Ages or back in antiquity, would not have survived 12 months. But today, this same animal would survive 12 months. So he clearly, as a prerequisite for this, he said there clearly was, he said there is an evolution within, but that evolution doesn't necessarily lead to the next step of changing the halacha. Why? Again, because that halacha was nikva based on whatever was the contemporaneous medicine of Chazal when they said it. The question again, and it's not so clear whether that shita of the Chazon Ish is a generalized shita, and that applies to all aspects of halacha, or is it just restricted to the case of treifa? I'll take your question, then I'll take your question. Yes. Right. So right. We just saw the Chazon Ish that did, but you know, there's some like you know creative nuances because of the Ben Zayin Ben Ches, you know, sort of loophole. But I don't remember if he said that explicitly. But he does obviously allow some areas of change. Yes. Yeah, you're gonna have the Ha'ara too. Excellent. Okay. Maybe this is just a choose around. Okay. So again, what we're doing here, in essence, is we're going through the very classic sugyas and the very classic sources of Nishtana Teva, and as one of you mentioned, this is also one of the classic sources, the astronomical debate. And this is the Gemara Pesachim. And I'm going to read it for you. For those of you, it is a very complicated sugya to understand. It's just a few lines, but it refers to theories of astronomy that date back to antiquity that the modern person really is wholly unfamiliar with. For those of you who are very interested in this sugya, just this week, Natan Slifkin put out an essay, a very lengthy essay, just on this sugya, on this paragraph, where he delineates all the astronomical understandings of the previous centuries and puts it into historical context. And if you can email me, I'll be happy to send you a copy of the essay. So here's what the Gemara says. Gemara says, Tana Rabbanan, Chachmei Yisrael Omrim, the sages of Israel say, Galgal Kavua Umazolos Chozrin, Galgal is the sphere, the earth, is stationary, Umazolos, the constellations revolve around it, they orbit around it. The Chachmei Yisraelim Omrim, the opposite. Galgal Chozer, the sphere orbits, Umazolos Kavuim, and the constellations are stationary. So I'm a Rebbe, Chugal and Yibreyam, Eolam Lomotzino, Egla, Bedorom, Be'akrim, Tzofon, because he raises the Ha'ara. We have never seen the constellation of Egla, which can be translated as the Great Bear Constellation, Be'akrim, and the Scorpion Constellation, Egla, Bedorom, this constellation in the south, and this constellation in the north, etc., etc. And then we continue, Chachmei Yisrael Omrim Bayom, Chamam Halechas Lamata Min Arakia, Chachmei Yisrael say in the daytime, the sun traverses underneath the firmament, however the rakia is to be defined, not so simple. Ubalai lo lamala min rakia. And in the nighttime, the sun traverses above the rakia. V'chachmei yomos ha'olam omrim, bayom chama mahaleches lamata min rakia. In the daytime, the sun traverses underneath the firmament. Ubalai lo lamata min karka. At nighttime, the sun traverses underneath the earth, not above the firmament. And Rabbi Yehuda Anasi says in a classic phrase which has been discussed extensively in halachic literature, "Benirin divrehen mi divrenu." In their words, the words of Chachmei Umas Olam appear correct as in contradistinction to the words of the Chazal, which are not correct. And he even brings a raya, says Shebiyom Ma'inos Tzonanim. Because the wellsprings in the daytime are cold, and at night they're hot, and if the sun traverses underneath the earth, so the sun is heating up the wellsprings, which is making them hot. So this phrase is a classic phrase, and how is this to be interpreted? Is it true, in fact, that Rebbe is saying Chazal were wrong and Chachmei Yomos Ha'olam were right? And if so, this obviously impacts significantly in our whole issue of Nishtana Teva, of being able to honestly, scientifically assess information and to be able to realize that is this information correct or is this information not correct. So the Rambam says here, V'lo tvakesh mimeni shiaskim kol ma shezachruhu me'ein atchuna l'masha inyan nimsa. Because don't try and ask me questions to clarify when Chazal talked about astrological or astronomical issues. Ki achachmus halimudis hayubizmanim hahem chaseros. Because this knowledge was not so well understood, and they had a lack of knowledge in that period of history. And this is the key point, which is emphasized not only by the Rambam, but the Avraham ben Rambam, his son, more clearly, which is probably one of the most classic sources in this discussion. When Chazal made this statement, I'm talking about the astronomy, this was not Halacha Moshe Rabbeinu Sinai. This was not a Kabbalah that Moshe Rabbeinu got and passed down from generation to generation. Rather, this was a statement made on the contemporaneous understanding of science and medicine. So they heard it from others, and this really is a key point. Which area, are there areas of science and medicine which are mentioned in Chazal which are considered Mesorah, Halacha Moshe Rabbeinu Sinai, which are absolute and irrevocable? Are there areas which are not part of the Mesorah, which the Rambam obviously includes here? And therefore, if you say that their knowledge was contemporary with their time, it's not Chas V'Shalom of Pagan and Chazal, it's just a reality of the evolution of science and medicine. That they understood science and medicine those days, they incorporated the contemporary science and medicine in those days and made their discussions accordingly. Science has subsequently evolved, so now that science has subsequently evolved, we have to react accordingly. And Avraham ben Rambam says the same thing, but he says it more clearly. He says, "Da ki ato chayv lo das, ki mi shiyirtzu lahamid das yadua v'lisa pnei omro l'kabel da'atov li'iyun v'habona l'inyan oso das im emes atayim lo shizemin hadeos aros." In essence, what he says, and I'll just synopsize it rather than read it inside, and it's really a sheet of his father that. Basically, you have to determine that the facts you're dealing with are scientifically provable facts and discernible by your logic and by your experimentation. Then and only then can you believe them to be truth. Because if you just accept words without attempting to discern the truth of those words, that's inappropriate. That's faulty logic, and that will lead to inappropriate conclusions. So the way he interprets this Gemara of in Psachim, it says Tanar Rabbanan Chachmi Yisrael Omrim, etc., etc. The Meata he's bonei ma shehoronu bebrais hazu ma yakar inyana shalomdu ki Rebbe lohi bi bedas elu ela bederech harayos b'li lasim alev lo lechachmi Yisrael lo lechachmi Yomos Olam. Because what does the Avraham ben Rambam say what Rebbe did? Rebbe didn't say, oh, I'm paskening lechachmi Yomos Olam because they're chachmi Yomos Olam. I'm paskening like Chazal because they're Chazal. No. Rebbe said, let's look at the facts and we'll pasken where the chips fall. And he said, it appears to me, based on my interpretation of the fact, that indeed the Chachmei Umos Olam have to be right in this particular case. So he writes, "V'emes nikra adon zeh rabbeinu hakadosh, ki ha'adam kishyashlech mi'alpanav ha'sheker." Someone who dispenses with falsehoods and lies, the kaim ha'emes, and sustains the truth based on experimental analysis, v'yachrienu la'amiso v'yachzigo midato, and he's able to retract his position, to honestly say, I was wrong, I looked at the evidence again, my initial position needs to be reevaluated, and when I reevaluate my position, I now accept your position. That takes a tremendous amount of strength, of personal strength, and that's why he says he's called, you know, by the Kinyan Rabbeinu HaKadosh. Just like this cartoon where it says, it takes a big man to admit he's wrong. I'd like you to be that man. But there's another shita, and that's the shita of Rabbeinu Tam. What does Rabbeinu Tam say? Rabbeinu Tam does not generalize this comment of nirin divrei midivreinu and say that this is a global, it could expand globally and say, yes, indeed, it is possible for Chazal to have looked at the facts in one way and even accept that their interpretation may not have been correct and to accept the positions of Umos Olam. He says, no. V'chein shamati, this is in the shita of Mekubetzes, v'chein shamati mishmosha Rabbeinu Tam zal, Shaya Omer Kane Al Hod Amrinan Beperik Mishaya Tame. Chacham Yisrael, etc., etc. The Amar Rabbeinu Tamzal, the Afal Gah, the Nitzchu Chachmei Umas Ha'olam L'Chachmei Yisrael, Hainu Nitzachon B'Tainas, Aval Ha'emes Hu K'Chachmei Yisrael. What does that mean exactly? So he says that what Rabbeinu HaKadosh, what Rebbe is saying, is saying, you know, you are correct, so you win the debate. You know, so you're a better debater than we are in terms of your discussions, but l'maisa, the truth lies with Divrei Chazal. So Rabbeinu Tam is not willing to accept the fact that there was a hodah, there was an acceptance of a misinterpretation and a revocation of a previous position. He said, no, Rebbe was not in any way revoking his position. Rebbe and ultimately Chazal are always correct, and in fact, that was the case there too. And regarding this is the picture of the Maharal, is regarding the evolution of human knowledge and the then new heliocentric theory of Copernicus. The Maharal Miprad commented, Ptolemy was right in his time, so why should not Copernicus be right today? In a few centuries, another revolutionary mind will arise and refute the theories of Copernicus, such as the progress of human thought, constantly exposed to the ups and downs of inquiry, guiding reason to areas of perpetual renewal. Now, we also mentioned, which was mentioned by Tosos, one of these other economy mentioned sugyas, and that's the sugya of Refuas HaShas. So you guys learning through different Masechtos, learning Masechta Shabbos, Masechta Gittin, you'll find a litany of treatments for medical conditions. Right? Now, I'm actually headed straight from here to the emergency room. So the question is, do I carry my Shas with me at the bedside? And if I see a patient with a particular medical condition, do I turn to Gittin? So this is a patient, you know, Ludama Duratia, someone who has a headache. And here you have another condition, Litzlichta, which according to many is someone who has the migraine type of headache. So do I pull out this Gemara and say, you know, you have to take this particular liquid and you have to pour, 60 cups of this liquid on the right side of your head and 60 cups on the left side of your head and take the herbs of this and the urine from a donkey and a whole host of things. So why shouldn't I? I mean, I paskin by the Gemara for many other things. So why don't I use the Shas as a medical textbook as well? So it was realized very early on that one cannot, not only one cannot, one should not use the Refuas HaShas for medical treatment. As mentioned, as early as the times of the Gaonim. Here you have from Otzer Gaonim from Pai Gaon. Srichim anon lemeimar lecha. Rabbanon lav asusa in that the rabbis were not physicians. Umilin be'alma dechazinin b'zmaneham, and what they would incorporate into the Gemara are things that they knew from their time. The lav divrei mitzvah inon hilkach lo tismechun al alin asuta b'leked avinin han meidam ela baser demivdek v'yadav v'vadei machmas rofin b'kim. Therefore, you should not, and according to many, it's a prohibition. You should not use the Refuas HaShas for treatment of particular individuals, because just like the Rashba was concerned, you might end up being malshin on Chazal. You can use a treatment for migraine headaches, which is mentioned in the Gemara Gittin. The patient's going to die as a result of your treatment and not going to survive. And you say, oh, Chazal were wrong. So he said, you cannot use these things. And the Ma'aril says, Amar lehu Mari Segal, call HaRefuas V'alachoshim Shebechol HaTalmud, and it's a notion which is perpetuated by the Chavis Yair also. And the Chavis Yair says, why can't we use the Refuas HaShas? And he mentions three reasons why we can't use the Refuas HaShas. One, the Gemara mentions certain medicaments, certain herbs, certain items that we simply do not know what Chazal were referring to. And maybe what they're referring to is not what we know today to be that particular herb. And second, he mentions the quantities and exact clinical application is not known, can't be extrapolated from the Gemara, because the Gemara is not a medical textbook. These things were mentioned derech agav. And the third possibility is that, in fact, possibly nishtana teva, that many of these herbs or treatments may have been effective back in the times of the Gemara, but these same treatments today would not be effective. And since nishtana hateva, you cannot use these particular treatments. Having said that, you know, there's a certain amount of humility we have to invoke here, because there are some herbs or treatments mentioned in the Gemara, even mentioned in the Rambam, which indeed are being used to this very day or being reevaluated today that might be effective for the treatments of certain conditions. But there are clearly many conditions which these treatments would not be effective. Even the whole of bloodletting would not be effective. This now brings us to the classic sugya, and that's the sugya of kinim, which someone mentioned earlier. And here we have the Gemara, which reads as follows. I'll just excerpt this, and we'll. It's talking about netilas neshama for animals, killing animals on Shabbos, and the issue of killing animals on Shabbos. So in that context, so shash gutsim, you know, other insects, if you kill them, you're chayev, ha-horgan chayev. And here the Gemara says, "Eliezer Omer haharig kina b'Shabbos." If you kill a louse on Shabbos, and this is a picture of a louse, "Kehareg gamal b'Shabbos." It's just as if you've killed another four-legged animal, a camel, i.e. your chayv, maskif leviyosef, etc., etc. Lo pligir abonin ela d'Eliezer ela b'kina. Why? What's the machlokus with kina? Kina is different from all other animals or all other insects or creatures. Why? The kina ena parvarava. What does ena parvarava mean? It doesn't engage in period of arivia, classic sexual generation. Rather, this is the pashtus of Gemara. Rather, it generates spontaneously. Meaning spontaneous generation. Now, what is spontaneous generation? Spontaneous generation, for those of you sitting in this classroom, may seem like a ridiculous idea. But the notion of spontaneous generation, that insects generated spontaneously, de novo, from nothing, was an accepted fact in medicine, we'll see, until probably the 17th, 18th century. So if you went to medical school or you went to university, for the majority of the history of time, you would be taught that spontaneous generation is a reality. Now, why was spontaneous generation believed to be a reality? Because it was observational. We're talking days pre-microscope. Anthony von Leeuwenhoek had not yet created his microscope, which was in the mid-late 1600s. So what they would observe is the following. They would have a picnic out in the field, and they'd put a piece of meat sitting on the picnic bench. And there'd be nothing around it. It would be a nice, clean, healthy piece of meat. They'd go and they'd play, and they'd come back in a couple hours, and lo and behold, there's all these little flying things around the meat. And in many cases, they saw the little maggots on the meat. So what could this possibly represent? So obviously, these weren't there before, now they're there now. I can't see otherwise. It must be that they just, came out of thin air. They spontaneously generate. And this, again, while seeming ludicrous to us today, was an absolute accepted fact for the majority of the history of the human race. When did this begin to change? This began to change. It was an evolution like everything else in science. This began to change. One of the classic experiments was by Francesco Redi, and this is the front page of his classic work. And very handsome fellow, I might add, too. And this is the picture of the experiment that he performed. And the experiment that he performed was an elegant, simple experiment, considered one of the classic experiments in the history of science. He took three beakers. I mean, it was more complex, but this is the simplified version. In one beaker, he put meat in all of them. In one beaker, he sealed completely. One beaker, he put a little gauze on top. And one beaker, he left completely open. So in the beaker that was wide open, so lo and behold, there was all these flies, all these little these flies. In the beaker that was partially closed with the gauze, there were, the flies themselves weren't there, but the flies had deposited eggs which became maggots, or maggot larvae, on the top of the meat. And in the third jar, which is completely sealed, there was absolutely nothing. So what did this clearly, unequivocally prove? Clearly, unequivocally proved that these little insects don't generate spontaneously. They generate from eggs which are deposited on the meat. The eggs then subsequently hatch and produce these flies. And this was the beginning of the nail in the coffin of this theory of spontaneous generation. It wasn't for another century or two until Louis Pasteur put the final nail in the coffin on a microscopic level. But here you have one of the classic sources on this issue of Nishtana Teva by none other than a figure by the name of Yitzhak Lompranti. Now, Yitzhak Lompranti, I'll just give you a very brief biography of Yitzhak Lompranti. Yitzhak Lompranti was an extraordinary figure of the Renaissance. He wrote the first halachic encyclopedia. So you're familiar with the Sdei Chemed in the recent generations, and you're obviously familiar with the Encyclopedia Talmudit. But the very first halachic encyclopedia was called the Pachad Yitzchak, by Yitzchak Lempranti. It was an encyclopedia which is an aleph to tuf halachic encyclopedia. And the reason he wrote this encyclopedia is because that was the genre of literature which became popular in that period of history. And he applied that genre to the halachic world in a magnificent way. And it's a multi-volume work called the Pachad Yitzchak. What is also interesting and unique about the Pachad Yitzchak, which puts him in a unique position to make the comment that he makes here, is that Yitzchak Lempranti was also trained as a physician. And at what university did he attend? He attended the University of Padua, which is the same university that Galileo taught in about a century earlier than Yitzchak Lempranti. Just as a very brief parenthesis, the University of Padua at that time was one of the only universities in all of Europe which allowed Jews to attend the university and to receive a diploma without avowing their belief in Christianity, a very, very unique aspect in the history of education. As a result, many, many Jews attended the University of Padua, traveling there from all over the world. I have a copy of the Jews who attended the University of Padua Medical School from roughly 1600 to 1800, and it reads like a who's who of Renaissance Jewry. And Yitzchak Lempranti was on that list. By the way, just another interesting parenthesis, did anybody get to see the Sotheby's exhibit of all those Sfarim in the Lunzer exhibit? It was about a year ago. Some familiar nods. Anyway, at that exhibit, which is probably one of the best collections of Sfarim in the world in private hands, which was being auctioned by Sotheby's, for those of you who have the extra cash, I think it was going for $40 million, which is a steal, by the way. For the stuff that they had. It's truly astronomical. He had a manuscript of the entire Pachad Yitzchak. So the Pachad Yitzchak's own handwritten manuscript he had available there. And I'll show you something else in a minute also. So what did the Pachad Yitzchak say? Pachad Yitzchak said, he obviously knew the science because he trained at the University of Padua, which is one of the greatest universities in Europe. By the way, down the road from the University of Padua was the Yeshiva of the Maharami Padua. And we have documentation of students that attended the Yeshiva of the Maharami Padua and attended the University of Padua, both the undergraduate university and the medical school. So it was the first YU, I guess. It says, V'ani ha-tzair ka-kosev, ilo de-mistafina, amina de-bizmanenu, shechach me-atodos hibitu v'ro v'yodu v'kosvu, de-kol ba'al chai yeh mishi yeh, havi mina beitzin. Said, me, the young student, it appears to me that now we know, given the fact that now we know that there is no such thing as spontaneous generation, that all beings, no matter how small, generate through sexual generation. The cholzeh chicho barayos baruros, and this has been proven. In Cain, shomer nafsho yirchak mihem v'lo yaharog lo parosh lo kina v'ayach nisas mo besafek chayachatas. It's a fascinating halachic application in the case of kina. What's the halachic application? The application is that in this case, if you accept the change in science, you end up being machmir, not being mekil. How so? Because in this particular case, if you say that the reason that they spontaneously, the reason it's mutter to kill a kina, is because they spontaneously generate. If you're machmir, if you accept the science that they generate sexually and they don't spontaneously generate, then you should be machmir and not kill them. You no longer have a heter to kill them. So that was his theory. And what did he do? He said, well, maybe you should be machmir based on the new science. So he asked his Rebbe, Rabbi Yehuda Brill, and Rabbi Yehuda Brill said, no, whether you're machmir or mekil, you have to rely on the words of Chazal. And he didn't even give him a license to be mekil in that case. I'll just skip this to get to the shittas. So how else was this classic sugya of kinim to be subsequently interpreted? And another classic interpretation of the sugya is as follows is from Rav Dessler. What does Rav Dessler say? Rav Dessler writes in the Michtav Eliyahu. Says Reisi lo shom kan masha shamati beperush shel Admor, which refers to Rav Dessler, written by Arya Carmel here. Kishenishal al odos dinim achadim regarding certain halachos shata'amim shenisnu lohem einu lefi hametzias shenisga b'mech shenis. So there's certain reasons which are given to the Gemara for certain halachas, and the reasons don't jive with our modern understanding of medicine. And what's one example? Hademutar laro kina b'shabbos, yishum shakina ain par v'rabba. You're permitted to kill a kina on Shabbos because a kina spontaneously generates. So how do you deal with such a thing? What do you do? How does that impact on the halacha? So he writes, and I'll just synopsize it for you. He says, even though it is true that our understanding of this reason of spontaneous generation has evolved, and we now know spontaneous generation to be not factually correct, it does not in any way impact on the practical application of the halacha. The halacha, according to him, the halacha was nikba, that is mutter to kill a kina on Shabbos. They happen to mention a reason which may have been palatable to the generation of that time, but it's not palatable to us because we don't accept spontaneous generation. Doesn't matter though. You still have to hold on to the words of Chazal, which Shtei Yodayim, he says, and you have to pass on the halacha irrespective of the fact that the Tam has changed. And I will read this. This is a beautiful passage. I'll just share this briefly with you. Another classic sugya, and you may not have heard of this one, is the Ophos HaGdelim Be'ilam. You know, people have a lot of money growing on trees. This is a sugya of birds growing on trees. And there was a belief in the times of the Middle Ages that in fact birds grow on trees, and the sources that you have in front of you discuss the halachic implication, because a bird is ton shchita normally if it's a regular bird. But if it's pre-eights, maybe you can just make an adama, or an eights, and eat the bird and not shech the bird. So there was this notion, which was subsequently obviously proven to be a false notion, that birds in fact grow on trees. And here's some illustrations from that period of time. So a question was asked to Rabbi Illoui, who was a European rabbi who came to the United States, I believe he practiced in Cincinnati in the 19th century. And someone wrote him this classic question. He goes, you know, I study the words of Chazal, and I'm very loyal to the words of Chazal, but notwithstanding all the good instruction I have enjoyed, I cannot conceal from you that I have met with several hypotheses in the Talmud which I can never acknowledge as true, since they are opposed to common sense. And he mentions one of these cases. He mentions the question, this case of there exists a certain bird that grows on a peculiar tree. And he said, it's not true. You know, how could I believe this? What does this do with my belief in Chazal? So Rabbi Illoui wrote, says, first, you want to know the name of a certain bird which grows on a particular tree, etc. But I would ask you first, how can you make so bold an assertion? Is it because you have never seen it? Can you, in your negative, gainsay the affirmative of many of the most celebrated ancient naturalists who affirm to have seen a bird precisely of this nature as mentioned above? So in essence, what he writes, and we'll see in a moment, is also the words of Shimshon Paul Hirsch, said, you cannot expect Chazal to go verify every single assertion that is made in any particular time in history. They don't need to go out in the fields and find this bird that grows on trees. If someone comes and tells them that the greatest scientists of our time say that this bird exists, and they present it, they put it on the table of the Rav, so the Rav says, if you say this exists, I'll tell you what the halachic ramifications are. But if it turns out later on that no such bird exists, it's not a pagam in Chazal. Chazal are not expected to go prove it or disprove it. When we're talking about science and research, we're talking about stem cell research. What if there is no such thing as a stem cell? Have any of you guys ever seen a stem cell? What if a stem cell is a hoax? Right? So you have, you know, hundreds of people writing about stem cells. You expect Chazal to go into the laboratory and have to look at a stem cell? But you guys actually should do that. Why? You should be going and looking at the stem cells. But you can't expect every local rub to do that. So it's not a pagam in the rub that they don't know that. So these are all of our chapters, and we'll close now for the next few minutes about some of the major thematic approaches to Chazal. Now here, these are just for your interest, and if those of you are interested in any more information, I'm happy to communicate with you by email and share with you any of the sources. So other sugyas which you may have heard about, there's two passages in the Aver, one for urine and one for Zera. Adnei HaSodeh, this creature which is half mouse, half dirt, the mermaid, Melastomes, fish and meat. Blood testing and paternity, a whole fascinating, many, many, many other sugyas. So I'm going to share with you a number of different approaches, and with this we'll close. Approach number one, we heard from Rav Dessler. When you have these cases where the science doesn't jive with the understanding of science today, one approach is Rav Dessler. Rav Dessler said that indeed there are factual errors in the Gemara, and Rahman al-Sam doesn't mean that they were wrong, but with our retrospective vision, it's not correct science. But it doesn't impact the halacha at all, because the halacha is dissociated from the tam. So the halacha remains the halacha, and even though that tam has become batel, and in that particular case, is kinim was a classic case. Chazon Ish's approach, which we also said with respect to treifas, that the halacha was established based on the science of Chazal. Chazal were correct in their scientific assertions, but those assertions have changed. The realities have changed. But here again, the halacha is absolute and continues based on those initial assertions, even though there has been an evolution and the science has changed. The other approach, which we saw illustrated by a number of people, is called the divine knowledge approach, which is a complete rejection of all matters that are put forth by science, contemporary science and medicine, that Chazal are always right. And here the Tzitz Eliezer says it, "Chol bedika madoit mitbatelet neged kabbalosam ha-ne'mona shel Chazal shekol divrei ha-ne'am u'beruach ha-kodesh." So he holds, really, that all these matters of medicine, in essence, are part of the Mesorah. And therefore, one cannot negate anything that Chazal says. And this is just some other sources which maintain the same thing. Another approach, which we did not discuss here, but merits at least mention, is that the assumption was that the interpretation of the Gemara was the Pashtus interpretation of the Gemara, and then you have to deal with the realities. What the Maharal says, in an approach really unique to the Maharal, and actually the Ramchal also has a similar approach, but basically not too many people share the same approach, is that you are reading the Gemara and you say, by Kinim it says, Eina par v'rava, and you want to interpret it to mean that these Kinim spontaneously generate. He says that's not the interpretation of the Gemara. He says, you are misunderstanding the Gemara. There is a deeper philosophical, perhaps even Kabbalistic level of the interpretation of the Gemara. If you sense a contradiction to your understanding today when you read the Gemara, it means that you missed the boat. You're not understanding. So he says that there, and this really resolves all these conflicts. He's saying none of these are ever conflicts in the Gemara. Rather, there is a different interpretation of these phrases of the Gemara which resolves all the issues. And the final approach, which is the approach espoused by the Rambam and the Avraham ben Rambam and the Rabbi Illui, is that although great in Torah knowledge, the sages did not possess better knowledge of the natural world than did other people of their era. And that period was limited. So therefore, it is quite possible that there are discussions in the Gemara which we now know in retrospect are not in consonance with reality. And Rav Hirsch writes in a famous letter, which is printed in a wonderful article by Dr. Lyman, says, "Anyone who engages in the study of the words of the sages must above all realize that they were primarily scholars of the divine law, transmitting and teaching the Torah and its precepts. They were not as such biologists, mathematicians, astronomers, or physicians, except insofar as knowledge in these fields was relevant and required for the proper understanding and observance of Torah and mitzvahs. Knowledge of these disciplines was not part of the Sinaitic tradition. Even in one's own field of study, it is neither possible nor expected to discover and to know everything by means of one's own experiments. Most of one's knowledge is dependent on researches done by others. Should those prove to have been erroneous, no blame is attached to the individual. I believe that wherever we find a startling statement of this nature made by the sages, and we research it properly, we will find that it was a widely held belief in those days." And the same is true by Rav Herzog, also a wonderful statement. And just to conclude, we have had a chance to discuss some of these chapters, but the interpretation and the halachic application of when, where, and how one can halachically apply Nishtana Ateva and potentially entertain the notion of changing the halacha is a very, very complex matter. And that one that either you could do or I could do really is left up to the Gedolei Hador when to invoke this notion of Nishtana Teva. And in this classic sefer, in my next slide, which you have fortunately in your handouts, has some classic makaros on this sugya. But Rav Nerya Gutal, in his sefer, the entire sefer is called Sefer Hishtanut HaTvaim, lays out 7 criteria that need to be applied in order to even consider the possibility of changing halacha based on the idea that the science has now changed or that we know things to be different. And these are the 7 criteria. One is you have to first analyze the origin of the halacha, whether it's doraisa or not doraisa, as we said by Treifos, since the halacha Moshe Mitzrayim, many thought that was irrevocable. Whether it's related to sakana, so for example, which we didn't discuss, mitzitza bepeh, is machlokas whether nishtana atonim by mitzitza bepeh. If it was an issue of sakana, it's much more complicated to change it. He says the change has to be 100%, meaning that the change of nature is not just a partial change, but it has to be completely changed. It has to be unanimous acceptance by all the poskim. What are the likelihood of that happening? Limited in scope and thorough investigation of all the halachic ramifications. And this final one, unidirectional change with no likelihood of reversal. So if there's a hishtanus ha-tvayim, and then the pendulum's going to swing back to the reality is going to go back to the way it was in times of the Gemara, you can't change the halacha because then you're going to have to change the halacha back again. So in conclusion, we've had an opportunity to discuss some of the general ideas in Mishnah Teva, some of the classic chapters of Mishnah Teva, which I hope will serve you well when you come upon these discussions in your future careers, and when your balabatim or colleagues ask you, Rabbi, how could the Gemara say this? We now know today that things are different. How do you deal with such a thing? And here you have in your last slide, these are some important sources for those of you who wish further study. These are really exceptional source material. The classic, most comprehensive, is Neria Gutal Sefer Hishtanut HaTzvaim. And for those who are interested in primary source material, this website, someone did a phenomenal yeoman's job in collecting all the primary sources that deal with the Hishtanut HaTzvaim, with Nishtana Teva, literally hundreds and hundreds of pages for your reference and for your analysis. So thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm happy to entertain any questions you guys have.
No questions.
No questions. Come on, you guys got to have one question. Nature has changed. Nobody has any questions. Okay. Shkoyach, well, gentlemen. For those of you who are interested in further study, don't hesitate to email. Yeah.
Do you guys have someone volunteering to be about FEMA?